And why are shareholders particularly grumpy? Here's a quote from Paul Flynn on an analyst call on the 25th of October 2022. He says, "Share buybacks have been and are expected to remain an efficient and value-creating way to return capital to you, our shareholders, particularly if the share price is undervaluing the company, which we believe remains the case." When he said that, Whitehaven share price was about 10 bucks. And he said, you know, the share price is undervaluing the company at 10 bucks. It's now $6.70.
Righto, money miners. Tuesday, got to check the date every fucking time. 19th of September, welcome to the show. Boys, I can, as I said before, feel a bit of coal dust on my face after this interview. The boys have gone absolutely balls deep into coal. Jeez, I'm talking balls deep. Like, we got beers in an hour and a half. Bloody, no fuck ups, no nothing. We're just sending it, all right?
It's not even an interview, mate. Just the three of us today.
Yeah, I know. Right, boys, Whitehaven. Shouldn't it be Blackhaven? Anyway.
It's part of the ESG polished image, mate. You call the black rock white.
Yeah. It's a pretty schmick looking annual report as well. Did you catch that?
Oh.
It's very polished, you know.
Got to appease the ESG guy.
Very good. We're going into Cyprium's little recap and a bit of unnecessary history of the nifty operation from me. I had to find something to do while you were going going deep on Whitehaven. Yep. So,
and they did have actual relevant news out last night, which is why we're talking about them.
Exactly.
Got you down the rabbit hole to start.
Yeah, exactly. I love you. He's a dog with a bone. Right, boys.
Let's get into it.
K-drill. Not sure if they drill for coal. Probably could. Coal would be easier due to the fracturable nature for Ryan O'Sullivan to break up with his bare hands if K-drill did start exploring for coal assets. But mostly probably WA-focused and RC drilling experts, you'd say. Wouldn't you say, Trav? You know your drillers.
Yeah. Do you even need a drill for coal? Like,
just poke in a hole every few hundred metres.
Oh, you just follow the fucking thing forever, don't you?
Yeah. I've got to do a trip over east. I'll take Ryan with me and see if he can just find a million new discoveries.
Just in case money of mine wants to go against ESG and get into coal mining, and K-Drill are probably going to be the firm to help us do it, though they do have extreme ESG credentials if you want to get them for a RC drill.
Well, I think some of these would contend what you're saying, but we'll get into that later.
I thought you were going to get involved then, JD.
Was I not?
Before we get into the coal stuff, mate, I want to add a little bit of colour on a couple of the conversations that we had yesterday. It was a pretty controversial episode yesterday.
I didn't even think it was, but apparently it was.
The first thing I want to talk about is De Grey. We hypothesised about the CapEx in the upcoming DFS, and there's been some commentary straight out of Beaver Creek on this one. Glenn Jardine, in his speech there, said we...
So that's a gold presentation for those wondering. There's a big conference up there in Denver.
Yep. And MD Glenn Jardine, in his speech there, said, "We also see the payback period that we're showing there of under 2 years. We see that continuing into the DFS due to the Brolga starter pit." So some signalling around the CapEx, which we talked about and speculated what it might get to. We'll certainly be paying attention to that one, JD, and how they maintain that two-year payback will be intriguing to us when the DFS drops. The other one I want to talk about, fellas, is Wildcat.
So we had, Wildcat.
So we had Bogan Geologist on our show yesterday, and Bogan had some pretty you know, intriguing commentary on that one, which got a bit of punchy commentary. Yeah, for sure. And I think it's worth adding a perspective from there's this geo on Twitter who just puts out really, really good content. His name is Dwayne Sparks at Sparks_Dwayne, and he says, "I've had a couple of people ask my thoughts on Wildcat's downhole drilling, in brackets drilling into the dip of the pegmatite. So I thought I'd just give my views in a post. I don't have an issue with it as long as the company is transparent with shareholders and that shareholders are aware that the grades within this drill hole could be well under or well over the overall grade of the pegmatite. The issue with drilling into the dip direction with the pegmatites is that pegmatite are generally zoned, meaning different minerals form throughout different sections of the pegmatite. Using the below cross-section, you can see spodumene typically not always forms a central zone within the pegmatite. As you can probably guess, you're drilling down dip, but there's a chance you could only drill through the ore zone if you drill through the spodumene zones. The grade will be well higher than if you smeared it across the entire pegmatite body. Your grade will be very elevated within this zone. The good thing about this type of drilling is that it can provide you with the initial depth of the pegmatite using a single hole. Hope this helps. Cheers.
Mm. Yeah, it did. I liked what he said. Oh, no, because that affirms what Bogan was saying about the irregular nuggety effect of the lithium, but I guess drilling through it does confirm some form of continuity and depth. But as I said, well above or well below, depending on which little skin. It looks like one of those cells you've seen in your science classes back in year eight, if you're great, on the YouTube.
So. Great picture. Thanks, Dwayne. And I think Dwayne's tweet's a really high density value. He's posting geology fundamentals in a pretty easy to understand way for the masses. We love his work. And let's get him on the show, guys.
Oh, mate, you can't put that shit up on Twitter, Dwayne, expect to not have to come onto the show to do all our geo shit for us. So.
Can everyone message Dwayne on Twitter and tell him to come on? I keep asking him, but he hasn't said yes yet, but one of these days he will.
Someone send us his phone number for a box of piss. Righto, boys. Whitehaven Coal. Get into it. I'm not even going to intro it because you've done fucking hours of work on this. So this is going to be good. Yep. I will sacrifice a beer for this.
Yeah. Well, we should crack a beer and have one while we talk about this.
Yeah, we've got a beer fridge now.
It's worth a drink.
We had a donated carton.
Doing a deep dive, Maddie, and there's a lot happening with this stock and we won't be able to do it justice in this segment, and I've been wanting to talk about it for a while. And the reason we're finally going to talk about it now, let's talk about the confluence of factors all coming together. There's a $1 billion M&A deal, well, a multi-billion dollar M&A deal that's on the cards. There's some shareholder activism. There are continuous disclosure concerns and there are corporate governance question marks.
This is a money of mine story.
That's got your fucking name written all over it, you two.
Big time.
So why it's in the news, Maddie, is you would have seen the sales process of Daunia and Blackwater, the assets held 50-50 in a JV between BHB and Mitsubishi, so known as BMA.
Fun fact, I had a scholarship with BMA at uni when I was doing mining engineering. $8,500 a year they gave me, and I never went and worked for them.
Wow.
I pretty much spent it on schooners, pokies and other things you could buy for $25 a pop. But, yeah, anyway, fun facts with Pat.
There you go.
Thanks, BHB. So I have something to contribute. Cheers, BMA. Sorry I didn't work for you.
So a quick bit of background on the financial position as it's relevant for Whitehaven. They closed the year with $2.65 billion in cash. They've got an $800 million tax bill that's due to be paid in December and they've paused the share buyback. So there's an initial period where they had to pause it with the annual report upcoming, a blackout period. And they've paused it again pending the sales process that we're going to get into regarding Daunia and Blackwater.
These are big assets too, right? I mean, yeah, Blackwater and Daunia, it's like 24 and 17 years reserve life respectively, but I mean, these things keep going.
Exactly. That's just reserves. That's not even taking into account the resource to reserve.
And that's a fucking huge, that's a big fucking mine. Like coal open pits are huge. Yeah, yeah. Different scale to our little pesky little undergrounds we talk about.
Remarkable. Like genuinely, yeah, insane scale.
All right. So let's get into the activist shareholder. So there's this group out of England, I assume London, called Bell Rock Capital Management. There are a fund that has accumulated a bit less than 5% of the issued stock of Whitehaven, and they've been pretty vocal, Maddie, about their dissatisfaction around management's disclosure of their capital management strategy. So they are fervently against Whitehaven buying these two assets, and they even engaged a research house to do a poll of what Whitehaven shareholders think of all of this. And
I like this form of I like learning about all the different ways that activist shareholders engage in the activism. For us, it's just yelling to a microphone, but for some people, it's polling the shareholders.
So were Bell Rock just very content sitting there with buybacks and massive dividends during this great period for coal? And
the outcome, Maddie, of that poll that they did, the various polls that they did, was an overwhelming number of respondents agreed that increased shareholder returns through the payment of dividends should be a priority, to your point there, Maddie, and that a clear majority of larger shareholders disagreed that the company should increase borrowing to invest in new mines.
Yeah, right. So how many share are they representing all the shareholders, or they're using their 5% shareholding as the voice?
Well, they've supposedly engaged this research house, which has gone and reached out to other Whitehaven shareholders. We don't know what number of shareholders responded to this poll.
Or how the questionnaire is structured and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But I mean, to speak to your point, Maddie, on capital allocation, were they just keen for buybacks and all that sort of stuff? Like that's the the point to sort of get into around the activism, right? Because one of the major critiques from shareholders relates to the suspension of these share buybacks by the company. Remember, buybacks are a way for like the company to return capital to shareholders. They paused their buybacks, Whitehaven. They paused it in August with their MD and CEO, Paul Flynn, stating that they would halt this, in quotation marks, while Whitehaven considers application of Whitehaven's capital allocation framework in light of growth opportunities. Growth opportunities. Yeah, oh, right. We're going to link it. We're going to link it all together.
So I think for money miners that don't know, a buyback is when the company buys back the shares and takes them off the register. The value per share goes up because there's less shares.
Yeah, the earnings per share and so on go up. There's two main ways to return capital to shareholders. That is issuing a dividend and buying back.
Yeah.
So when they paused these buybacks, the share price fell off about 17% over the week subsequent to that announcement. A lot of shareholders remain concerned that capital will get allocated to bad M&A rather than distributed back to shareholders in the form of buybacks and dividends. And why are shareholders particularly grumpy? Here's a quote from Paul Flynn on an analyst call on the 25th of October, 2022. He says, "Share buybacks have been and are expected to remain an efficient and value-creating way to return capital to you, our shareholders, particularly if the share price is undervaluing the company, which we believe remains the case." When he said that, Whitehaven share price was about 10 bucks. And he said, you know, the share price is undervaluing the company at 10 bucks. It's now $6.70. And JD and Maddie, I'm not sure why you say it's undervalued at 10 bucks, but seemingly not so at $6.70.
Oh, there's some fascinating details in and around that trading at those various price points, which we're going to get into more later.
So is this company saying, the activists saying, do they not like the Blackwater and Daugherty deals? Like they think they don't want to go into any M&A, or is it specifically these two?
It's risk. Like the big thesis that's exciting to you as an owner of Whitehaven is the fact that they've got these assets, they're producing lots of cash, and they're going to deliver returns to shareholders by way of a buyback. A big M&A deal is just risk that the capital that you have, you know, rightfully accrued from these, you know, great times, blah, 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 is just going to go to something that might not work out. We're not saying that we won't get it on accretive terms, and we'll get into what we think about that later on, but it's just risk as a shareholder. You'd prefer the certainty that the capital gets back to you rather than risk the downside of M&A, especially when it's in the multi-billion dollar price tag, which we're talking about.
So, righto, what about the disclosure, the poor shareholder communication you mentioned? What's going on there?
Yeah, so the wording that they like to use is selective disclosure in and around this. So
tell you only the good shit.
Pardon?
Tell you just the good shit.
No. Select who to tell.
So what has been accused, what they've alleged the company has done, is after the annual meeting, which we actually spoke about, Maddie, a couple months ago now, there was an investor meeting for a select group of investors in Singapore where they were told information that not all shareholders and investors broadly were told. So, you know, uneven distribution of the same information. So they were asked the question in the analyst call at the end, are you interested in buying Daugherty and Blackwater? And I think what I said at the time is that they just played it straight back. They said, we look at everything, and Daugherty is proximate to one of our growth assets in Winchester South. So they didn't confirm that they were interested in these assets. So then it came out over the weekend that these guys, Bellrock, had written a letter to the company asking for clarification and perhaps confirmation on whether they were in fact interested in picking up these assets. And hence we come out to the point yesterday with Whitehaven coming out with the announcement that saying they are in fact in the bidding process for these two assets.
Yeah, right.
And this is the intriguing part, is because there was this allegation that some investors knew that beforehand. The stock had been trading really strangely, and I think that's kind of the uncertainty part of it has been what's created a little bit of disgruntled shareholder dynamics, because you've seen the stock have really weird intraday trading as a result of uncertainty about how they might fund a potential acquisition.
So is that the drop from 10 bucks to $6.70 where it is today, has that been a lot of that fueled by this M&A speculation?
But both thermal and met coal prices have come off substantially over the last year as well, so not purely attributable. And on the last bit on the announcement that they came out with yesterday, it was only sort of four odd lines. And, you know, quite prominently, the last line is that the company will continue to abide by its continuous disclosure obligation.
Yeah, right. Okay, so how's Chuck Whitehaven in the mix of going to take over these big, massive BHP assets? Are they operational ready? I think we've see you've written here, history of production misses.
Well, I think this is – the history of production misses is actually relating to Whitehaven themselves as a company. Like when you talk to Whitehaven shareholders, they're really quick to point out that Whitehaven has a tendency to downgrade and miss guidance consistently in a way that you rarely ever see for similar size miners. It's like something to behold. Mondi on Twitter, who's a great Mintuit analyst at Mondi Invest on Twitter, he tweeted about this back in April and he charted up the downgrades and guidance misses on annual production guidance since FY19 for Whitehaven. It's pretty compelling when you look at it, right? The tweet here says, a quick look at past guidance attempts from Whitehaven using the top end of range given each time. FY21 had 4 downgrades, FY23 on track to be the lowest in 5 years, even at the top end of current range.
So that's one downgrade a quarter in FY21.
Yeah, and I mean, he's talking about the guidance for the full year guidance.
And they only just got it.
And yeah, I mean, like, so his last point there is constantly bullish and constantly missing, hashtag cold Twitter.
And they've had 3 already.
Well, this was an April tweet, so it's a bit dated. But yeah.
Yeah, wow.
All right, why don't we get into the alignment of the board? We'll chat about a couple directors. So first up, Raymond Zage is a non-executive director. So he's a bit of an interesting character. He's founded a company called Tiga Investments. He'd previously started the Asian business of the hedge fund Farallon Capital. So they're a huge, huge US, I think the headquarters in San Francisco, huge hedge fund. And he's also ex-Goldman Sachs prior to that.
He's a bit maligned by Whitehaven investors because Farallon sold $300 million of Whitehaven stock, or about 95 million shares in November 2019. Now, Farallon's sale is disclosed in an ASX announcement. It's a Form 605, which was lodged on the 15th of November 2019, showing an agreement to sell, which was dated the 11th of November 2019. So then on the 18th of November, Raymond Zage lodges an Appendix 3Y showing that he, in his personal name, as a director, has acquired 9.2 million shares between the 11th of November and the 15th of November. Now, note that this disclosure says he did not hold any securities prior to the 3Y. On the 5th of December, so just a few short weeks later, Whitehaven provide a guidance downgrade. These guidance downgrades weren't uncommon, as we talked about earlier.
Yeah. So, just to round out on Zage, he still owns, as of now, owns about 11 million, or a bit over 11 million shares. So he's got a substantial personal holding.
Okay, so he was the founder. His fund sold a shitload of shares and then he bought some back personally.
Yeah, at about the same time.
Yeah, a fund he'd previously worked for but was still an advisor to.
Okay, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, next.
Paul Flynn, CEO and MD.
I think Paul is perhaps even more maligned than Raymond amongst some of the noisy Whitehaven shareholders out there, fellas.
And they are pretty noisy.
The critique.
Dumb question. Yeah. Maligned.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that misaligned?
No.
Not aligned?
No.
What's
not,
maligned?
Not loved.
Mean? Yeah. Not loved.
Not loved.
Yeah.
Geez, I learned a lot around you boys. Cheers for that. Continue
no
on.
No worries. So Paul, I think the critiques from Whitehaven shareholders about Paul, they kind of actually do sort of, they're related to minimal alignment and selling of Whitehaven stock personally as over the journey.
Why don't we go through, you know, the last 5 or 6 years of how, you know, you look at his compensation and then his sell downs of the stock.
The vast majority of the stock that Paul has owned over the journey has, you know, come about by way of his remuneration package and performance metrics and all that sort of stuff. And he's regularly, sold them those shares down in sizable packages over the journey. Starting, like, I mean, we can just go back over the last 5 or so years. In September 2018, he sold 32% of his then position for $3.3 million.
June 2020, he sold 43% of his then position for $1.8 million.
In March 2021, he sold 38% of his then position for $1.8 million. And less than 3 weeks later, there was a production guidance downgrade.
In November 2022, he sold 46% of his then position for $7.8 million. Less than a month after his quote about there being value for Whitehaven to buy its own stock back at the $10 share price, which is what we touched on earlier.
There's some big fucking chunks of your stock sell like of ownership selling in one go, isn't it?
Yep. And today he holds slightly over a million shares, which is the lowest number of shares held by Paul since 2017.
So let's tie in why this all matters. Let's get into the remuneration dissatisfaction amongst shareholders. So in 2021, 53% of shareholders voted against the company's remuneration report. So you pretty rarely see this. That's one strike against them. There's a sort of mechanism where they have to get, you know, a certain amount voting for it in the next financial year, which they ended up getting. But on this 2021 vote, the key concerns that were flagged by shareholders were misalignment between guidance and short-term incentive gateways from a production and a cost perspective, a lack of minimum shareholding requirement. Third point was a perception that the management was not held to account for some environmental incidents. Also that there were too many incidents occurred for their stretch outcomes to be awarded. Limited short-term incentive target disclosures, and we might get into that later. It's very opaque to work out what the actual pay is incentivized around. The sixth point was high CEO pay relative to their market cap and competitors, and there was another point as well.
Some of those points have since been addressed in the subsequent remuneration reports, but we'll talk about that a bit further down.
Yeah, right. Tell us about Daunia and Blackwater then.
Why don't we start with how, you know, the market and how various commentators are valuing them? So sort of a good point to start, I think. So we've sort of drawn data from a few different people, commentators and whatnot out there. UBS, Respeculator from Twitter and Koala as well, The Australian, The AFR, they've all had a stab at valuing these things.
Respeculator, you just put in the same category as UBS, mate, he'd be fucking flattered about that.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'd rank him there, 100%.
Good stuff, mate.
You know who I'd rank on the other side? I won't say.
I know exactly what you're getting at. The AFR, to start with, they said that BHB put a US $3.5 billion price tag. Now, that's for both the assets.
Yeah, and I think we saw some pretty silly headlines out of The Australian on this one, with numbers as high as US $6 billion. I think those numbers you see floating out there, they're converging lower and lower. You know, UBS, I think, might have been the first sell-side house to actually individually value the two assets and write a specific note in relation to what they could be worth. And they come up with US $3.3 billion for the two combined, the distribution.
Yeah, Blackwater for $2.5 billion and Daunia at $800 million.
And they both have to go together?
Yeah, we're going to get into that later, but BHB are trying to sell them in a sort of two-for-one. They want to get rid of the two of them together.
We'd assume so. That's what we've heard, but yeah.
So the Koala, another sort of Twitter and Substack writer, came up, laid out a bunch of assumptions on a lengthy Substack post, which was kind of interesting. Some of the key assumptions were using a 2x EBITDA multiple, which is relatively comparable to what the companies trade at, and a $200 long-term met coal price. And his result was US $2.4 billion, which is a step lower than the other ones we've commented.
And, yeah, Respeculator sort of... thumbsuck number pens about US $3 billion in his math. You're seeing the numbers sort of converge towards that $3 billion mark and maybe a bit below three.
I wouldn't
be surprised to see it sort of converge around that $2.5 to $3 billion mark.
What's coal to – because remember it was up at bloody $500 a ton a year or so ago. Now off the top of your head?
Last time we spoke about it, it was in the 150 to 200 sort of range.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've got various different benchmarks. These guys get a premium to the Newcastle Thermal Coal Index. Like, I think they got over the FY23, got a 10% premium.
Yeah. Because of the met coal, the coking coal.
Because of the quality, supposedly, of their coal.
That Nuke is what the Whitehaven's current assets are tied to, but Daunia and Blackwater have a different index.
They sure do, and that's part of the allure to potentially buy into assets that are met coal as opposed to thermal coal projects and completely change the complexion of their asset portfolio. That's a big draw.
Which
it wasn't all the money going in and met coal around Hunter Valley because it was more premium for using it as thermal coal.
Oh, there was a period in time where, the dislocations in prices were a bit funny. You saw thermal coal trade even higher than met coal at one point, which created an incentive for met coal to go to thermal use cases for a while. That was when energy was going crazy around Russia, Ukraine. But I think the point that a lot of Whitehaven shareholders are nervous about when it comes to a big M&A deal like this and using capital that they thought was going to come back to them for this is they're worried about how it's going to be financed. Like if they pay too much, we talked about what valuation might be. If they pay too much, how are they going to fund it? Are they going to have to do an equity raise to fund it? Is it all going to come out of the cash reserves? Are they going to need a debt facility, which might have some terms which aren't favourable to shareholders. So all of that's on the mind of existing shareholders when they think about the risk in owning the stock at the moment.
So we'll start with cash and looking at how they could potentially finance a transaction. So we touched on them having 2.65 billion Aussie dollars. Remember the prices we quoted were US in cash. They've got 800 million to be paid in tax in December. That number was of June 30, so you can imagine that they'd made a few hundred million dollars in free cash since that time.
And then, if they, if the acquisition price is such that there's requires some debt finance or they look at that debt, then, you can factor that into it. It'd be curious to know what the debt pricing could ultimately be. I think we can look around to see what other, debt for coal companies has been priced at recently. So Stanmore recently got rates in the vicinity of about 12% interest rate on its US $625 million debt facility to acquire 80% of BMC. And intriguingly, one of the lenders of that facility is Farallon Capital.
Oh.
Relates back to Raymond's Age.
Yeah, there you go.
Plot thickens, man.
Oh, God.
I think it's worth touching on vendor financing. This is a method that some analysts had put forward. So this would simply be where, in a simple example, where the person you're buying an asset off would help finance the purchase for you in a style of loan, i.e. in this case BHB or perhaps the JV loaning the capital to the acquirer.
Do you see that often?
Vendor finance? It probably happens at the small end of town a bit, but like it can also happen, in instances where the companies who are trying to bid for an asset don't have funding capability, but the seller can sort of wear that for a while and wants to sell,
Yeah.
Like. Yeah, exactly. And another important element too is just can strategic partners actually contribute to the financing in some sort of way?
It's not that dissimilar to what we've seen in the lithium space actually with offtake partners. So in this case, you might have the likes of a steel mill, people that want to lock in supply. And similar to the offtake partners like automakers for lithium, they're worried about a supply shortage. They want to lock it in. In this case, the steel mills have probably noticed that not that many met coal projects have been, coming online recently, and there's a bit of a dearth going forward of these assets coming online. So they want to lock in supply so that they can continue to make their product. So they might be interested in being a strategic partner or also putting up some financing. So that could be, taking 25% of the asset itself or alternatively helping finance it.
Because met coal is a bit different to thermal coal in terms of the whole ESG thing, is it? Because thermal coal thing is based on not using coal-fired power station, but we're still going to need steel.
Yeah, there are a lot of renewable energy aspects that will need steel. You'll need coking coal to make steel. So these assets by these companies, they're still backing them to have long lives, around that reserve life, because it's going to be needed for the energy transition as well, which is a point that's probably confused in the media.
Yeah,
We talked about the UBS note. They actually model that customer, like strategic partner sort of finance for, they call it a customer in bracket steel mill sort of or trading house coming in for 25% and paying 50 to 70% of their portion with cash. The remainder with debt is sort of how they model the funding mix of their scenario.
It's fascinating given the buybacks they've done. recently and how long these things have been on the chopping block to be sold for. So,
right. So why? What about BHP as the seller? What's in it for them? It's not going to bloody be a piss in the ocean for them.
But. So there's obviously the ESG reasons and their institutional investors wanting them to push away from all coal-related products.
Or at least the mix away, yeah, to more future-facing and less old world.
You've also got them being very upset with the Queensland government at the royalties that got scaled up last year. That's another reason they're not investing in any greenfields projects in Queensland, so they're quite upset with the government there. This is another way of reflecting that. And you just have to say that they're probably a little less sensitive to price. BHP being BHP, they are quite tuned in to who the actual buyer is and making sure that the asset goes into the hands of a responsible buyer at the end of the day.
When you're talking about assets that have substantial rehab liabilities, it's really important that you sell them to a party who has, you know, history of actually embarking on rehab in the right way and can fund it in the right way and all that sort of stuff. It matters a lot, especially in the context of, you know, BHP sort of saving face.
It's a brand thing. Is it long term?
Yeah.
If it goes to shit and they sold it to them, they're...
$3 billion is, you know, a bit less than a percent of their market cap.
Yeah.
If the perception of them as a owner of a business were to change, a 1% change would be, and their share price would be much more influential, you know, over the long term if that were to substantially change. They're pretty detrimental.
I think we should have a bit of a conversation about the M&A overhang and the M&A fears that are out there in the market amongst Whitehaven shareholders. Clearly sort of, I think we've got to ask the question, do we think the M&A fears are overblown? And when you compare the performance of Whitehaven versus New Hope over the last month, you see pretty divergent kind of performance, which is kind of surprising. You'd expect them to actually move to get together in a lot of ways. And I think the overhang is actually largely in relation to the M&A fears that are out there.
Yeah, I think you're right, man. And one of the concerns that Bellrock had raised in their activism was that the buyback would be ended for good, and you know that's really upset them, probably along with a number of other shareholders in the stock right now.
So, Whitehaven, I think you mentioned it before. Are they using this as a bit of a mix or a pivot to met coal, or trying to mix the thermal and the met, or what? Trav, what's your view on, I guess, I suppose you've got to separate the ESG versus the investment case.
Well, I think it's a talking point. Like, why are they so keen to like go into met coal? I don't actually personally think the supply demand dynamics for met coal are as, you know, compelling as they are thermal. So I think that's part of the uncertainty and overhang and everything like that. I find it a bit odd that Whitehaven are so publicly keen to get more met coal in the mix because, like obviously there's the peak China narrative and that's bad for met coal, but there's also, like less exposure to the energy price squeeze thesis if you go hard on met coal and less mix on thermal coal.
I suppose a counter to that would be that, you know, this company is very close to coal, far closer than we are, and they perhaps, you know,
maybe
that would be the dynamic, or that would be the argument that they would make.
Yeah.
In them, you know, perhaps it's like India growth or something like that, or emerging market, but.
Yeah, and I mean, met coal is debt financeable, and I don't think thermal coal is debt financeable anymore.
I don't think it is at all.
Right.
So they've said that on the analyst call. They've said banks would be willing to finance met but not thermal coal projects.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So let's say Whitehaven buy these two assets for $3 billion, hypothetically. Going to be a good deal or not?
Oh, we'll have to reserve our it depends how they finance it, right? Because if you
– what do you say the finance word? Will it be accretive?
Accretive, yeah. And, I mean, like the big fear in the market is that if Whitehaven – are successful, it won't be a good deal. And it's a valid fear. I think there are some dynamics of the sale process that lend itself to the counter argument in that position though. And those are that there's like a limited pool of bidders left. Yancoal's reported to be out. There's rumours Peabody's out too.
BHP are getting out. Every of the big ones are getting out.
So there are other rumours floating about that, you know, Whitehaven were one of, if not the only party to actually put a bid on both assets. And BHP, you know, they likely want that simplicity of selling both at the same time to the same party. But, you know, buying from BHP, like there's another element too, and that's it buying these assets from BHP. They're a forced seller in some ways because they got pressure on them from investors to have a higher mix of future-facing commodities instead. And, you know, there's mine life beyond the reserve life. Whitehaven Coal, they probably have a much higher long-term price on met coal too. And like these kind of circumstances, this confluence of circumstances is usually the confluence of circumstances that lead to getting a deal done on attractive terms because, you know.
Okay. So then, okay, bring the management in. You went through the management and the historical selling of shares. Mm. We've got the companies, I guess, how they're looking at the future for coal. What do you think, I guess, the management's incentives are on this?
That's the other thing too, is like how do you know they're going to do it on attractive terms? What if the incentives are to get a deal done at any price because incentives aren't properly aligned? And what's the quote we always say, JD? Show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome.
Right. So a specific example, Maddie, would be if one of the incentives for management is just to simply grow production, then it'd be very easy for them to go and do an acquisition at any price and get it done. Not saying that's specific here, although their management's incentives in Whitehaven's case are confusing to say the least.
So JD and I, we looked at the remuneration report in the FY23 annual report to try and make sense of what sort of KPIs there are for management. Safe to say we were left with more questions than answers after reading it. A big portion of that.
Lucky I didn't fucking try.
A big portion of that exec remuneration appears to be linked to an SIP structure. 80% of the SIP outcome relates to KPIs on a scorecard. Now, you look at this scorecard, 25% on the scorecard relates to EBITDA, 20% to ROM production, 15% to FOB cost per tonne. There's some other stuff there, but those are the three I want to talk about.
It's very ambiguous to say the least. What is it specifically about EBITDA that is the goal? What is it specifically about production or costs that are the goals? We don't know.
Yeah, what? How many tonnes have you got to get?
Yeah,
what is the ROM production? Yeah,
and it's at the board's discretion, really.
The question I have, and maybe there's some remuneration experts out there that can clarify, I'm not making accusations that these incentives are poorly aligned. I actually don't understand them well enough, Maddie. But like the question, open-ended question I have is like, are these KPIs achieved? Can they just achieve the KPIs by acquiring other assets?
So like, is it a combined ROM production?
Yeah, like is it if it's just a flat EBITDA target, then EBITDA growth isn't accretive for shareholders if you end up diluting shareholders to smithereens to get there. And same with ROM production. And then you've got the FOB cost per ton. Like that's another metric which. Like imagine a scenario if you acquired assets that had a lower cost basis, do you just, instead of actually lowering cost at your existing assets, do you just have on a group level lower cost? Those are the questions I'd love to have clarified as it relates to,
And there's another element as well, Trav. The performance rights, they're tied to, in quotes, strategic priority delivery measure.
Yeah, this is another part of that REM package there. I read this part here, JD, and I thought.
I mean, there's a quote that stands right out from going through it, right?
Yeah.
New initiatives that add to long-term coal reserves and enhancing resource security. So
sounds like M&A is part of that one.
It sure does. But like we said, quite ambiguous, so we wouldn't mind getting that cleared up.
Yeah. The big point is M&A for the sake of M&A is bad. It's important to make sure incentives are aligned to actually creating shareholder value, and you've got to make sure these metrics are tied to things like, you know, demonstrating improvement on a per share basis for metrics, and also like that can be hacked if you just add debt into the system on a per share. You got to risk adjust and all that. There's a whole bunch of stuff. I'd love to do a podcast with a remuneration expert on what incentives should actually exist out there.
Hopefully they think when they do those remuneration packages, like, fuck, we don't want these money of mine pricks to be on. Like, we've got to, if we can influence how these things are done out of fear, he's job done.
Pretty proud of that, Matty.
Right. What do you say? After all that, well, let's fucking sensational. What do you think of Whitehaven Coal?
All right. Why don't we talk about how the stock trades, right? The valuation. So, I mean, quite intriguing that the company trades at 1x book value. That sort of stands out. I mean, the multiples of coal businesses in general stand out. And if you look on an EBITDA multiple basis, you're talking about 2.3x FY24. So,
considering the gold that trades at 6 and
gold
6 to 9.
I'd call it 4 to 5 for the mid tiers. But
we talked about some high quality gold companies.
High quality ones are at bloody 9, aren't they?
Yeah, I think Capricorn last time we looked were 8-ish.
Yeah. I Like that 2.3 times, it's even somewhat comparable to Yancoal now, which is like an amazing thing to think about, because Yancoal's always had a huge multiple discount for its Chinese majority ownership. I think, you know, when you talk about what do we think of Whitehaven Coal, let's talk about the context of the New South Wales royalty regime that was recently introduced. When that came out, the news of that came out, all the New South Wales coal stocks actually went up because the market was pricing in a royalty that was going to be higher than was actually announced.
They were pricing in something a bit more similar to what Queensland had done probably a year or so prior. So, and of course, Queensland would be relevant given that, that's where these assets sit.
Mm. And then you've got...
growth projects.
Yeah, I mean, so Whitehaven, they've got some growth projects. They've had some challenges in situations relating to permitting. Winchester South, we talked about it.
The proximity to Daunia.
Proximity to Daunia and infrastructure.
So you've got Vickery as well.
Makes sense for that. There's Vickery they talk about for a long time.
The company said that they don't want to develop these assets concurrently, which is kind of interesting. But I think the question you should ask yourself with these growth assets that haven't been recently discovered is, why have they not yet been developed? So, you know, what we sort of hear is that there's challenging geology, permitting, not so simple. You got farmland and a nearby creek and all these sorts of things. So it sort of lends itself to potentially buying an asset being more straightforward than building.
But this M&A overhang, like we talked about the trading valuation, that's really low multiples. And, you know, there's definitely a portion of the market who's fearful of bad M&A, in quotation marks. And I think that, you know, the overhang could be an opportunity for the people who took a contrarian view and they had a different view because they sort of saw the potential deal to, you know, might actually just be accretive and they take a better view on coal and all that sort of stuff. So
I got a couple more things I want to mention. Firstly, there is potential that some of the bidders that went in only bid for one asset, likely being Daunia rather than bidding for two of them. So wouldn't discredit the thesis that only one gets sold and the other asset gets parked by BHP, similar to an asset that they have, Mount Arthur in New South Wales, that they'd previously tried to sell. And my last point, as we're talking about activists, Bell Rock, there is no better channel to get your message out there. Come on, say your thesis. You know, Whitehaven are going to hear it. We know they're going to hear it. So come on the show and get your picture across of what you really think about the situation and what you want to get across to shareholders and management alike.
I reckon if you combine my feelings towards Ryan O'Sullivan, Seamus Langer's Bondi, that's how Trav would feel towards
shareholder activism.
Bell Rock.
shareholder activism. Like a Bell Rock, probably the owner, the main man of Bell Rock, Trav would be just have his tongue down his throat, I reckon.
Come on the
He's
potty.
Your type of guy, Trav.
I'd also invite Paul on the potty. So Paul and Bell Rock would be pretty cool.
One here, yeah. One right there.
We're only a phone call away. I'll run the cameras for you.
All righty. Well done, guys.
Good on you, boys. Bloody sensational. I look forward to re-listening to that, to divulge, to bloody take it all in. Right. We better finish off with Cyprium. They were in the Cyprian, the nifty restart.
All right, let's fly into it. So they completed a capital raising that we spoke about earlier, Maddie. We spoke about it 2 or 3 months ago. These guys have been in trading halt since February. So a long-awaited return, which we might actually see soon. So
yeah, and so for money miners, this is the nifty copper mine up in the Great Sandy Desert.
Sure
right
is.
Right near Telfer. It's had a colourful history, which I'll go into a bit later. JD, what's going on here? The placement has finally got over the line, some interesting capital structure.
That's it. So to fly through it, mate, they raised $24 million in a placement. They took $5 million in an entitlement offer. They had to discount this by over 60% to get it away. Plus there was a 1-for-2 attaching option exercisable at 6 cents. So that, to say the least, strongly, strongly incentivized shareholders to take part in this one.
Okay, so as you said, they've last traded at 11 cents. They got a 4-cent raise. They got the 1-for-2 attaching option at 6 cents.
Yeah.
What's the draw card with these 1-for-2 attaching options for the, I guess, the brokers doing the deal? And then we'll talk about the implications towards the actual shareholders. How does this get it over the line?
There's a couple of different aspects, Maddie. The main reason, though, is the attraction that they can relay to their clients, you know, that you can potentially, you know, you can buy into this. It's heavily discounted. recapitalizing the business. You got this attaching option, and I think one of the aspects you might be alluding to is that you got that sort of free ride, you know, that option at 6 cents. I mean, if we get into the capital structure, which we will in a minute, gives people a bit of cover if they want to, you know, cash in the shares that they have purchased at 4 cents. They've got that option to just hold on and see, you know, if the company gets this up and running, gets away with it. I've got that. I've got a free bet.
Yeah, right. So you can just chuck the money in for the sake of it, sell it straight away, and then you've just got a free option.
Yeah. So the company ultimately just has to focus on their job, on turning Nifty around, yeah, getting the job done, because there's no two ways about it. The share price is going to come off so massively. There's
potentially a lot of selling pressure at that. If it retraces, opens at that 4 cent level after the raise, there's potentially a lot of pressure there if the people are using that trading, that strategy.
Yeah, I'd anticipate there's going to be a huge amount of volume when the stock opens again. So the capital structure right now is pretty wild. You've got 1.5 billion shares on issue, 420 million unquoted oppies, like we said, exercisable at 6 cents, 80 million warrants, exercisable at 4.8 cents, 115 million performance rights, 100 million in convertible notes. It's paying 4% per annum. Per annum.
Yeah.
Like it's not pretty, right?
Yeah, because those convertible notes are from when they purchased it off Metals X, I think. It was $9 million bucks
worth. There was another convertible note that was done just a quarter ago for $21 million.
So. Yeah, right. So, okay, they've requested to have the voluntary suspension now lifted.
Yeah, they still need to meet a few ASX you know, listing criteria to be listed again, but hopefully for shareholders that's happening soon.
Yeah, right.
I mean, essentially it's, you know, bad luck for past shareholders, recapitalize the business and give it another go now.
Yeah, right. So it's a copper bet.
It sure is. It's an asset that sits high up on the cost curve. So you're really betting on like quite a few other actual copper assets in Australia on that copper price going upward from here.
That's high up on the cost curve from their 2022 cost numbers as well. So I'll go into them.
That's right.
Them later. So,
Matty, give us the history.
Oh, the history. So you'll see there's been a bit of board restructuring, and one of the guys coming back on is Milan Jerković. He's coming on as the chief operating officer. So it rung a bit of a bell. So
I know this guy.
Yeah. Well, so look, Nifty. I'll give you the history of Nifty. So that was it was discovered in 1981 by Western Mining. They mined it from 1993. Pardon me, Nifty, it was purchased then by Straits Resources in 1998 for $53 million. They spent around $20 million on it, expanding it to the current capacity of like the leaching capacity they got now, 27,500 tonne per annum. And then they sold it to Aditya Birla in 2003 for $159 million. But they had 69 of that went straight out the door to pay for debt and repayments. And Metals X then took it over from Aditya Birla in 2016. But Milan Jerković was the long-serving CEO of Straits.
So to round that one out, then it went to Cyprium when Metals X got rid of it in 2020, right?
Yeah, sold it to Cyprium. We've got it now. So Milan was actually the long-serving CEO of Straits.
Which is now Aeris.
Which is now Aeris. So he was until 2012. So he actually was the CEO of the project back when Straits had it. And then
I don't think the Straits share price did too well over that time from memory.
No, yeah. I'm not sure. Not sure. You can see what the money they put in and what they sold and what they had to pay back the debt. Don't they didn't look like it performed. Milan then became the non-executive director of Metals X. When Metals X owned it. But then in September 2019, Metals X, one of their major shareholders, APAC Resources, put in a 249D notice to remove two of the Metals X directors due to destruction of shareholder value. And one of these directors was Milan Jerković. So he stepped down from the board immediately. So he's got a bit of a history with Nifty and now coming back on as the chief operating officer. So
wow, Matty, I want to get a bit of your take on. There was a sinkhole at the mine.
It was on the news and everything for numerous reasons. And then
it's a bit under 10 years ago now, right?
Yeah. So we talk about like the surface subsidence and stuff at at Capricorn Copper, talking about the water going low. That's because it's a sub-level cave. But this is a this isn't a sinkhole because there's a sub-level cave. It actually resulted from underground stope or stopes self-mining all the way up into the edge of the pit. And I'll show you the picture here. So it's like pretty much the it self-mined itself all the way to the surface, right, and it come out right at the edge of the pit next to the haul road. So, very lucky that that didn't come out in the haul road while the bloody ute was driving.
Bloody lucky no one was hurt, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, look, then there was an ABC article out, and it's where the workers, you've got the workers' quotes and then the company quotes from Aditya Birla. The workers claimed that the sinkhole was like due to a lack of backfill because, to my knowledge, from the outset at Nifty, the paste plant there extremely underperformed and they couldn't even come close to like filling the stopes as quick as they were mining it. And when that happens and you've got a lot of open voids and mining out of sequence, this is the result. This is what can happen. So according to that ABC article, like the workers were actually stood down for 2 months without pay indefinitely. And so you had Aditya Birla claiming that the company cannot reasonably be held responsible for the current stoppage. And then you've got, but then you had the mine foreman who ABC interviewed saying the team in charge of backfilling the stopes could not keep up with the amount of ore being taken out, and to make up in for the fall in the quality of ore being extracted, the company also ramped up production. Ramping up production means you're opening up more voids that you cannot fill. So, and the workers were actually pooling funds together to start a class action against Aditya Birla, and the company was subject to an industrial relations dispute due to them putting the workers on indefinite unpaid leave. So I think they eventually paid them redundancy. So look, now we'll go through the mine plan. So now they've got to mine that open pit in and around that sinkhole, which is not an uncommon thing. KCGM do it all the time, like with old workings, but that sinkhole is the legacy of that version of Nifty. So if we talk about Aditya Birla, they had the Nifty copper mine. Bit of trivia for you boys. Do you know what copper mine they sold in 2015 to Lighthouse Minerals, NDMR?
In what year?
2015, they sold a copper mine. Oh. Do you know what it is?
To Lighthouse and NDMR.
Either Capricorn or Golden Grove?
Golden Grove.
Nah. Mount Gordon, which is now called Capricorn Copper. So they were the owners of Capricorn Copper previously, and it went on care and maintenance in 2013. Mothballed, they say. So that's how that went in AMR, and then that's now 29 Metals. So,
they got a bigger problem than bloody.
Oh, that makes sense.
Paste not being backfilled there now.
You don't need paste there, but there's obviously I probably wish they did have it now. So I guess you look at the nifty restart, and you look what's happened there historically from being a predominantly underground mine. Now this is proposed to be a big open pit, and I guess the red flags when you look at the restart study from 2022. It doesn't have any bloody pictures of what the pit is going to look like, what the ore body looks like, where it is. It just like you think it'd be good to know where the high grade sulfide ore starts. Like even though that's not included in that study, that study's just for the oxide ore to restart the leaching. You just want a bit of context on what this mine is going to look like. So I had to go back to like 2021 and 2022, and then back to the old Metals X presentations and studies to see what it looks like. So you can see here, you've got that's the existing open pit. You've got the underground under that, and then that green is the big sulfide resource. So they claim, I think it's 579,000 tons of copper, contained copper within that sulfide resource. But you can see that's in and around that existing underground. So that there, because as I said, their study's just from a 6.3 year mine life, but potential to go to 15 plus years. So, and we'll get into that. So that's what she looks like. Very, very interesting. And you see this cross section I've got here, that big curved ore body. It's down, that sulfide and everything looks down bloody deep if they want to go and access that. So I guess what the pit is going to look like, this is what I found from Cyprium back in 2020, I think. And you look at the Metals X picture here, it's going to, they're pretty much going to take out a big chunk of those leach pads eventually if they do go and do this sulfide expansion project. So,
Matty, I haven't read the study, but I remember being under the impression that the restart revolved around, yeah, heat leach. Like, can you still do that in WA? Just like,
yeah,
restart, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so like that's what Saturn planning to do. I think there's, I don't know if there's existing, I'm not sure if there's an existing heat leach operation in WA, but so they're pretty much going to, so part of their resource is the old heat leach pads that have already been leached that they still contain copper, and they're going to pretty much re-leach them,
right,
move them and re-leach them. So that's part of the actual restart. And as I said, like, it looks like the majority of that sulfide resources, a big chunk of it is in and around the existing underground. So now they quote 596,000 ton at 1.8% copper. But I guess the question I have is that, are they going to have to mine the open pit into the old underground to get it all out? Because a lot of the thesis for it is saying that they just want to do it open pit because it's a lower unit cost. And I couldn't find anything in the Cyprium thing to say, are they, even though they're quoting that there's potential to go to 15 years, but how are they, what will that entail? And I actually went back to the Metals X scoping study in 2020, and it actually states here, in areas where open pit mining will excavate into the existing underground mine, yada, yada, yada. So if they do go down that road to have this potential 15-year mine life to get the high-grade sulfide ore, it'll be pretty bloody interesting trying to navigate yourself around a shitload, a whole underground mine underneath you.
Gotcha. Yeah. Just because of the ground void, support
the
issues.
The voids, like you could, that's the thing, when you're working around voids in an open pit, you blow something up after the blast, next minute there's a big hole there, or there might be a skin left, and then the hole gives way while people are working. So there's massive like void management, open hole policy, procedures, void management procedures, like testing breakthroughs, everything. It's a big thing to, So KCGM do it because there's a lot of old workings from the Golden Mile days.
Yeah.
This would be, not sure where into the underground, but that'll be very interesting. But it's not, you look at the metrics of this project, it's a head grade for the leaching, solvent extraction, electrowinning part of it with the oxide ore. Head grade is 0.65% copper, and the 2022 study had C3 costs of US$282 a pound with pre-production capex of 150 mil. But that was at a copper price of $4.08 per pound. So, look, we can assume the C3 costs since then would have gone up, and the copper price today is sitting at $3.78. So you mentioned the cost curve, JD.
What level study was that? Was it scope?
That was a restart study.
Restart.
So it's a scoping. That's a scoping study.
Yeah.
So yet another project waiting on a much improved copper price, because at those margins with everything up and down, you can't see that getting there, and the capex as well. So, because they were trying to get like a $240 million facility to facilitate. They've gone through that many attempts to get funding, financing over the last couple of years, and it's just...
Yeah, and I should round out on that financing, the 24 placement and $5 million, they actually had oversubscribed, so they took in 7.6 as opposed to just the 5.
Yeah, so it looks like to restart it based on what they were trying to get, it could be like, $200 or $300 million. To try and get it back happening again. So even after this, once they get trading again, they're looking for a big finance deal to get it happening.
Love it, Matty. Well done.
There we go. Nothing compared to you two boys. Well done on the bloody Metcal. Love it. Diversifying. Trav, there is an element you like. We're just going to reach those coal barons on Twitter.
It's hashtag coal Twitter. Yeah, I like the thought. I like the thesis of the coal Twitter. I think there's a lot of merit to it myself, and I'm keen to talk more about it, and keen to have people who are pretty experienced in that space from an analytical perspective join us to talk about it.
Mate, if you're a guru or you know of a bloody coal guru, give us a fucking ring. We'd love to have you on. Right,
and a couple of partners to thank before we round out.
Oh, how could you forget the partners, JD. You could, mate. Cheers. See those lights? See those lights up above us? The fucking partners are paying for them at the moment. The lights wouldn't be on without the partners. SMEC Power and Technology, K-Drill, Terra Capital, JP Search, and Anytime Exploration Services. We bloody love yous. GCs.
Hooteroo.
Hooteroo, money miners.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.